Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Berlin Airlift, The Cold War Mission to Save a City, by John Tusser and Anne Tusser. Foreword by Sir Michael Burton. Narrated by Michael Page. Foreword. Sir Michael Burton. When I was the British Prime Minister and Deputy Commandant in Berlin during the last 5 years of the post-war four-power occupation of the city, which ended with its reunification in 1990, the memory of the blockade and airlift of 1948 to 1949 was still very much alive. The three Western allies, the US, Britain, and France, gathered every year, together with the leaders of West Berlin, to place wreaths at the memorial outside Tempelhof, the former US military airport. The memorial takes the form of a broken arch, symbolizing the beginning of a bridge. The German term for the airlift is the rather more graphic Luftbrücke, or air bridge. The corresponding Western arch is at Frankfurt International Airport. At the wreath-laying ceremony, we were remembering those who lost their lives keeping West Berlin supplied with basic foodstuffs, medical supplies, and fuel during those fateful 15 months. Although the airlift was US-led, it so happens that the largest number of names recorded is British, largely due to a single aircraft crash. The background to these events, as graphically told in Anne and John Tusser's superbly researched book, is that the four victorious powers of World War II, the three Western allies plus the Soviet Union, agreed at the Potsdam Conference at the conclusion of the war that, in addition to defeated Nazi Germany being divided into four zones of occupation, Berlin would be divided into four Allied sectors. The problem was that as the three Western allies became painfully aware when they moved their troops up to garrison these sectors, Berlin was squarely in the middle of the Soviet zone, closer to the Polish border than to the inner German border. The Potsdam Agreement provided for three air corridors with guaranteed access to Berlin from the Western Allies' zones in the west. But there was no corresponding agreement on guaranteed road and water access to the city. This distinction became of critical importance when the Soviet Union imposed a blockade of Berlin in 1948. It was sparked by the Allied decision to introduce a new currency into their occupation zones, the Deutsche Mark, in order to promote a revival of the shattered German economy. The Soviets, by contrast, favoured exacting maximum reprisals from that economy rather than helping it off its knees. When they closed off the access by road and waterways at the inner German border, the Allies were faced with a dilemma. Whether to force supplies through along these routes and risk confrontation and even war with their erstwhile Soviet ally, or to supply the city along the legally guaranteed air corridors. The dramatic story of what happened is recounted in this excellent book. The airlift produced many heroes, such as the city's mayor, Ernst Reuter, whose inspirational rhetoric called upon the world to look upon Berlin's fight for freedom. Among the air crew flying the planes carrying the supplies, of which there was more than one a minute landing at the RAF station at Gatow at the busiest time, there was, for example, U.S. Airman Gail Halverson from Utah, who earned the undying gratitude of the Berliners by dropping sweets to the children. But the main heroes were the ordinary people of the western sectors of the city who, in spite of their hunger, spurned the offer of improved rations if they moved to the Soviet sector and decided to rely on the Allied airlift. The fact that the airlift was bringing relief not just to the Allied military garrisons but to the city's civilian population as well was a critical factor. Not only did it make Stalin realize that the blockade was failing to starve the city into submission, to induce the Allies to withdraw, and to turn the Berliners against them, it also changed the fundamental relationship between the Western Allies and the Berliners living in their sectors. Previously, it had been that of occupiers to occupied. After the blockade ended, it became more like a partnership in the cause of keeping West Berlin free and democratic. and in time it evolved into feelings of genuine friendship on both sides. On October 2, 1990, the day before the solemn reunification of divided Germany in Berlin, the Allied authorities in the city, of whom I was one, met for the last time and wrote a letter to the Berlin House of Representatives. "The commitment of our three countries to Berlin," they wrote, "was based on a conviction that freedom, democracy, and self-determination must be upheld wherever and whenever they are threatened, and whatever the cost. Today the world looks on Berlin and sees a triumph of freedom and the human spirit. The epic events of the Berlin airlift made a major contribution to this happy result." Sir Michael Burton. Introduction. On 31 March 1948, General Lucius D. Clay, the military governor of the American zone of occupation in Germany, sent a telegram from Berlin to General Omar Bradley, Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army in Washington. "Have received a peremptory letter from Soviet Deputy Commander requiring on 24 hours' notice that our military and civilian employees proceeding through Soviet zone to Berlin will submit to individual documentation and also will submit their personal belongings for Soviet inspection. Likewise, a permit is required from Soviet Commander for all freight brought into Berlin by military trains for the use of our occupation forces. Obviously, these conditions would make impossible travel between Berlin and our zone by American personnel except by air. Moreover, it is undoubtedly the first of a series of restrictive measures designed to drive us from Berlin. It is my intent to instruct our guards to open fire if Soviet soldiers attempt to enter our trains. Obviously, the full consequences of this action must be understood. Unless we take a strong stand now, our life in Berlin will become impossible. A retreat from Berlin at this moment would, in my opinion, have serious, if not disastrous, political consequences in Europe. I do not believe that the Soviets mean war now. However, if they do, it seems to me that we might as well find out now as later. We cannot afford to be bluffed." This message was not unexpected. It was frightening, nevertheless. It announced a grave crisis in the relations between the four powers, the United States, the Soviet Union, Britain, and France, whose alliance had defeated Germany in 1945, and whose forces had occupied and run the country ever since. The confrontation between the Soviet Union and the Western Allies continued for over a year. Clay was right. The Russians did, indeed, take a series of measures to drive the Americans, British, and French from Berlin. By June 1948, the city was blockaded, and it seemed likely that 2.5 million Berliners would starve to death or be forced to accept Soviet domination. For a year, the Western powers, too, faced a grim choice: either to surrender Berlin, and with it plans for European reconstruction, or to prepare for another tragic war on the continent. Politicians and diplomats conducted dangerous maneuvers to avoid either terrible possibility. In that time, they created a different Germany, formed new alliances in Europe, and built up two opposed political and economic systems. From spring 1948 to midsummer 1949, Berlin was the hub of a European emergency and of European change. The time to avert disaster and create security was found in an element which Clay had mentioned, but whose potency no one yet understood: the air. In the air, the Western Allies created what Berliners called a Luftbrücke, an air bridge, which carried food, coal, medicines, and raw materials to beleaguered Berlin. This airlift brought more than supplies. It gave hope to the city and to much of Europe. How the time was used, how Berlin endured the siege, is the story of most of this book. To understand why the time was needed, it is necessary to go back, to see why the four powers were in Berlin, and why the city was so vital to them all, why the Western Allies were so vulnerable to Soviet pressure, why some would countenance another world war to retain Berlin, why the West struggled to keep alive those who had so recently been their enemies, why Berliners would risk death rather than their independence. 1. Fumbling the peace. From summer 1945, Germany was occupied by the four armies which had done most to defeat her in the Second World War: the Russian, American, British, and French. For administrative convenience, they divided the country into four zones and split the city of Berlin into four sectors, one zone and one sector for each victorious power. Berlin remained the capital of Germany, but there was no German government. The country was controlled and run by the military government of the four powers. Insofar as they had common policies, these were drawn up in Berlin by the Allied Control Council, made up of the four military governors of the zones. This much, but little else, had been agreed during the war. The Allies who fought Hitler had seldom considered what they would do if they won. As the American Senator Arthur H. Vandenberg put it in February 1943, "We must not fumble the peace, but there are very definite limits beyond which post-war planning cannot yet go." The British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, speaking to a joint session of Congress a few months later, gave one reason for this reluctance to look ahead. "We must beware of every topic, however attractive, and every tendency, however natural, which diverts our minds or energies from the supreme objective of the general victory of the United Nations." That victory was far from certain. It is easy now for historians and armchair generals to spot decisive battles and to identify strategic turning points when victory was ensured. It was not possible then. No one could feel confident of beating Hitler until his armed forces finally surrendered. Up to the last moment, every effort and resource had to be directed to one goal: winning the war. Decisions on what to do with the peace had to wait. The four powers had general aims in the European war, of course. France, like other countries conquered by Hitler, sought liberation, reparation for the degradation and pillage she had suffered, and adjustment of frontiers to give her greater security in the future. The British fought at first to avoid invasion and then to overturn Nazi domination of the continent. The Americans were fighting to stop fighting. They wanted to end their involvement in yet another quarrel which was of European, not American, making, and which consumed vast American subsidies. They wanted to go home as soon as possible and stay there. Their visions of the future remained broad and idealistic: a world won for democracy and liberal capitalism, which would flourish under a new world organization created to settle disputes and prevent war ever again. The Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, promised Congress in 1943, "There will no longer be need for spheres of influence, for alliances, for balance of power, or any other of the special arrangements through which, in the unhappy past, the nations strove to safeguard their security or to promote their interests." The Soviet Union, by contrast, was often specific and practical. Joseph Stalin, the Soviet Generalissimo, made clear to the British Foreign Secretary, Anthony Eden, in December 1941, that he wanted recognition of all the gains the Red Army had made since 1939, the Baltic states and part of Poland, for example. His price for entry into the war against Japan in 1945 was to move into Manchuria, North Korea, and Sakhalin. Underlying their aims, the three great powers, Britain, the United States, and the Soviet Union, had interests which would prove incompatible. Britain was concerned with the defence of her empire, the maintenance of preferential trading agreements with it, and her traditional search for a balance of power in Europe. The United States opposed imperialism, supported a free market, and saw old European diplomatic concepts as indefensible morally and a failure in practice. Yet Britain and the United States had agreed on a set of principles for the post-war world: the 1941 Atlantic Charter, no territorial aggrandizement by the victors, and recognition of the right of liberated peoples to choose their own governments. That agreement, however, conflicted sharply with the ambitions of the Soviet Union, whose leader, Stalin, had neither negotiated nor signed it. As the war ended, Soviet armies marched into Romania, Bulgaria, Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia. In autumn 1944, Stalin explained to the Yugoslav communist Milovan Djilas the political consequences of such military deployment. Whoever occupies a country also imposes on it his own social system. Everyone imposes his own system as far as his army has power to do so. It cannot be otherwise. Though few were privileged with so clear a statement of Stalin's intentions, many suspected them. But there could be no confrontation with him while the war lasted. The alliance had to be preserved if the war were to be won. Could Stalin be persuaded to change his policies once it ended? Churchill increasingly thought not. Stalin might be bullied, but not persuaded. President Roosevelt was more confident. "I can handle Stalin," he often said, and he believed that an alliance with Stalin was essential in the post-war period. If a world organization were to preserve peace, then the Soviet Union must be a full member of it. If Europe were to be stabilized and rebuilt, the acceptance and assistance of Russia were essential. If Germany's defeat were to be permanent, her military potential must be destroyed once and for all, and the Russians would have to be party to occupation until a new order had been imposed. Stalin appreciated all of this and was ready to play his part where it suited Soviet interests, in security above all. He prophesied to Djilas in 1944, "Germany will recover, and very quickly. It is a highly developed and industrial country with an extremely skilled and numerous working class and technical intelligentsia. Give them 12 to 15 years and they'll be on their feet again, but not marching, if Stalin could help it." On one aim at least, the three powers could agree. Their coalition would fight until it received Nazi Germany's unconditional surrender. President Roosevelt had been the first to call for it in 1943 at Casablanca. His fellow leaders responded enthusiastically. All of them had lived with the consequences of Germany's surrender in 1918, the myth that the German politicians had stabbed the military in the back when victory was within sight, the constant danger that Germany would wreck the peace negotiations by refusing to accept their terms, the tragic process through which the Versailles peace settlement was turned into a pretext for Nazi power and renewed war. "This time," said the Allies, "German surrender must be total. The victors would hold the country until it was fit for re-entry into the community of nations." The Allied leaders, however, were unwilling to consider in detail how Germany's institutions should be redesigned for that purpose. Subordinates in London and Washington struggled to draw attention to the need for long-term policies, but they were waved aside. Churchill, in the assessment of one Foreign Office official, was quite allergic to any proposals for post-war action which he had not himself engendered, or at least discussed personally with the President of the United States. There would have been little point in discussing Germany with Roosevelt. The President told his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, in October 1944, "I dislike making detailed plans for a country which we do not yet occupy." Stalin might have had plans, but he did not discuss them with Churchill or Roosevelt. Yet there was one possibility which the Big Three did discuss during the war, the total dismemberment of Germany. The logic was simple. The unification of Germany by Prussia in the 19th century had involved two major wars, with Austria and France, and the ambitions of the new state in the 20th century had led to two world wars. Never mind the scruples of historians and a few politicians, leaders and public alike during the Second World War blamed Germany for causing it. She must be rendered impotent and broken up. The suggestion of dismemberment was floated by Stalin as early as December 1941 in his talks with Eden. Stalin wanted to rip out Germany's vital organs, all of which were Prussian and were tainted in the popular imagination with militarism. The Rhineland could be made independent, though areas might be given to France to provide her with a long-sought Rhine frontier. East Prussia could go to Poland and part of Silesia too, Czechoslovakia would take the rest, and with Germany more or less dead, there would be no reason why Bavaria should not be chopped off and become a separate state. Alternative schemes of dismemberment were considered in Britain and in the United States. According to a folk story, diplomats in London plucked out faded old German princedoms from the Almanach de Gotha in case they could be transplanted to a recultivated Holy Roman Empire. One policy committee recommended the creation of at least 8 states. In the end, the Foreign Office decided to decide nothing and to wait and see if spontaneous separatist tendencies emerged. Many officials in London, however, preferred unity. They feared that the Russians might cut off their own occupied area of Germany from the rest of the country, that the remnants would turn to the west and friction would be created between the Allied powers. All too accurately, some Foreign Office memos were warning by 1945 that the anti-Nazi alliance must devise common policies for Germany as a whole, or else there would be a de facto division of the country, and perhaps even 2 opposed blocs in Europe. In Washington, an advisory committee of experts, set up by the Secretary of State Cordell Hull in 1942, advised against dismemberment on the grounds that forcible division would encourage German nationalism and aggression. That did not deter the State Department from continued musing on the subject. Should Germany be broken up permanently or only for a punitive period? How many states should there be? 3, 5, 7? Should the Ruhr, the heart of German coal and steel production and the centre of the armaments industry, be included or put under international control? By the beginning of 1943, the State Department was tentatively considering the creation of 3 German states, though it was still apprehensive that this might stir up aggressive nationalism. The department produced a policy paper in July 1943, H24, Germany Partition, which presented all the arguments for and against. Hull decided against dismemberment. For the time being, so did President Roosevelt. He merely recommended to Eden in March 1943 that we should encourage the difference and diversities that will spring up within Germany for a separatist movement and, in effect, approve a division which represents German public opinion. One wonders where some British and Americans got the idea that there might be such separatist tendencies. Was there any evidence that Bavaria or Württemberg had stronger local patriotism than, say, Wales or Texas? By the end of the war, however, Roosevelt had changed his mind. At the Tehran Conference from 28 November to 1 December 1943, he talked of splitting Germany into 5 states and of putting the Ruhr and the Saar, as well as Hamburg with the Kiel Canal, under the United Nations or some other international body. Churchill preferred dividing most of Germany into 5, then forming a confederation of the 4 states which met on the Danube. Stalin remained silent. The matter was dropped. The leaders gave up the leisurable diversion of drawing and colouring in fantasy maps and got on with the serious matter of winning the war. Though the ultimate shape of Germany had not been decided and no long-term policies for governing the country had been agreed, the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union realised that a few basic arrangements for administration must be made before the end of the war. In Moscow in 1943, Antony Eden proposed to his fellow foreign ministers that they should set up a clearinghouse for all European problems connected with the war and its aftermath. The Soviet foreign minister Vyacheslav Mikhailovich Molotov and Hull, however, preferred to limit its brief. The European Advisory Commission, the EAC, was to stick to planning the terms of German surrender, the nature of the occupation regime, the instruments of control by the Allies, and the arrangements for the administration of Berlin. A challenging enough task. The Commission was established in London at Lancaster House. It held its first meeting on 13 December 1943, then a series of formal sessions from 14 January 1944. There were 3 members, American, Russian, and British. Perhaps there should have been a 4th. The British wanted a French representative, and the Free French under General de Gaulle put in a request to join. They were blackballed by the Americans and Russians. Stalin was unwilling ever to concede any role to France. He had once suggested to Roosevelt that the victors should be a club of those who had contributed 5 million men to the war. 3 million, Churchill had put in sharply. Stalin despised the French. They had opened the gates to the enemy, and Pétain, not de Gaulle, was their true representative. Roosevelt, though less scathing about the nation as a whole, did have a strong antipathy to de Gaulle, and the United States did not recognize the French provisional government de jure until 24 October 1944. Only then was a French representative invited to join the European Advisory Commission. René Massilly arrived at Lancaster House in November, bringing, thought Sir William Strang of the Foreign Office, a welcome professional touch. It came rather late to be of much use. Most of the agreements of the Commission were already drawn up, and Massilly could only witness them. The American member of the European Advisory Commission, the ambassador to Britain, John Wynant, was remembered by Sir John Colville, Churchill's private secretary, as a gentle, dreamy idealist whom most men and all women loved. He was a close friend of the Churchill family and enjoyed the full confidence of Roosevelt, though in his EAC role, as will be seen, he was not able to take much advantage of it. An acquaintance reckoned that Wynant was hopeful and confident of post-war collaboration with the Soviet Union, though sometimes rather bewildered by the attitude of his Soviet colleague F.T. Gusev, the Russian ambassador in London. However, since Wynant was a nice man, he attributed Soviet intransigence to lack of familiarity with Americans, and worked hard to overcome suspicions. Russian intransigence was familiar to Sir William Strang, the British representative on the EAC, from other dealings with Soviet diplomats, including a pre-war mission in Moscow. He was less prepared for Gusev's insistence on keeping everything in his head rather than available on paper. He learned to live with Gusev's typical Russian habit of sticking out for a point for weeks or months, then suddenly saying, "I have no objection," without giving any explanation. Strang himself, soon to become permanent undersecretary at the Foreign Office, was a professional diplomat of long experience in German affairs. He had been at Chamberlain's meeting with Hitler in Bad Godesberg in 1939 and head of the Central European Department of the Foreign Office with Germany as his main concern. Strang was the only one of the three who could devote much time to the Commission's work. Wynant and Gusev had their ambassadorial duties. He was also the only one who could act quickly. His superiors were on the spot for consultation. Gusev, on the other hand, had to refer every jot and tittle to Moscow, and there were long delays before he received instructions. Moscow was never famous for speedy dispatch of business, but in this matter Gusev's colleagues suspected that the Soviet government was delaying on purpose, hoping their bargaining position would improve as their armies advanced. Wynant was kept on a similarly short leash by Washington, and responses were equally slow, but for different reasons. Policy in Washington was confused, and authority was divided. Throughout the war, the State Department's activities had been restricted to limited matters such as economic warfare and post-war problems such as food, relief, and monetary arrangements. Roosevelt had virtually excluded his Secretary of State, Hull, from high policy decisions and from negotiations with his allies. The President kept these to himself or delegated them to the Department of War, which did not now relish the prospect of losing any of its authority. As a result, the State Department did not have sole control of Wynant's activities, for all he was an ambassador and engaged in diplomatic negotiation. They had to play second fiddle to the War Department in a special liaison committee created to draw up Wynant's instructions. Within this committee, the Civil Affairs Division of the War Department, the CAD, acted, in the opinion of a close observer, like lawyers protecting their clients' interests rather than as partners in a common purpose, and insisted that topics on the European Advisory Commission's agenda, such as the future zones of occupation, were a purely military matter to be decided not in London by diplomats, but at the proper time at the military level. In his negotiations in London, Wynant was that most hapless of...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?